This is Dr. Trina Coleman, host of Beyond the Classroom. Today, our guest is James Fakunle. He is a graduate of the University of North Alabama with a bachelor's degree in marketing and a master's of science in entrepreneurship in applied technology from the University of South Florida. Right now, James is an instructor of computer and information systems, as well as entrepreneurship at Livingstone College. Professor Fakunle, he's in the process of helping our undergraduates do research. Without further ado, let's hear from Professor Fakunle.
How are you?
Let me ask you a question. I just read your bio and you sound like you're having a great time. You are mixing STEM and entrepreneurship, which is something very few people are doing. So tell me a little bit about your work and your passion. And are they one and the same?
Well, yeah, they are. My work at Livingstone College, I work as a professor of GIS, of course, and entrepreneurship. Right now, we're in the process of revitalizing both programs, some of the business programs and some of the GIS programs. We want to intermingle them so that our STEM students or our tech students don't just leave with a knowledge of, technology only. We've got a really interesting program here. The chair of the department, Dr. Valadon, has done a great job intermingling a lot more coding and different things of that nature, just to make some of the students, all of the students more viable when it comes to going into the workplace and securing high-paying jobs. But what we want to do is we want to intermingle that entrepreneurial aspect as well, because we know really that's where real wealth is created. So they brought me in, I'm thankful for that. And we're just working as a team to make sure that Livingstone is one of the top-notch HBCUs in the land and that our students can go out and rightfully command their place in the global society.
Well, that sounds fantastic. How many students do you guys have at Livingstone right now in the STEM and tech programs?
In STEM and tech programs, I'm not quite sure. I will say with our HBCU UP grant, the students that we have participating there, it's right around 32 students.
Wow.
But I'm not familiar with all of the students throughout the program. We have math, of course, CIS, and biology that represents, represented here at our school.
Okay, so you have a math program and a computer science program and biology. So that's great.
CIS, yeah.
Yes. What type of research do your students participate in your three programs under the HBCU UP program?
Well, we've got a few different research things going now. I can tell you one that's been most prevailing is they've been doing some work with a different type of, you call it solar power. I forgot don't get me to get into the particulars on that one, but it's a mixture with the math and biology students. So they were going in that with our CIS department. They've been doing a lot of things with coding and just a lot of development from that standpoint with applications, apps for your smart devices and different platforms like that. So, yeah, that's mainly what we've been doing.
Okay, so you have an interdisciplinary type arrangement set up under your UP umbrella, so to speak, where you have all of those three different disciplines working together on a project, bringing their expertise and coming together?
Well, yeah, for the most part.
Well, that's great, because a lot of research efforts tend to be siloed off. The math people do their math. The science, physics, biology, or chemistry, they do their thing. And I guess right now it makes sense to be more interdisciplinary, which takes me to my next question. How do you integrate the entrepreneurship into the research efforts with respect to the three disciplines we just spoke of?
Well, that one is a little more tricky, I'll be honest with you. And right now, what we're trying to do, of course, entrepreneurship, in its essence, is taking resources from an area of low output to an area of high output, right? So what we want to do is we want to get to the point where we can, I guess, get everyone on board to push for research within a particular area that we think would be most profitable. Right now we're just a part of the UP program where we're responsible for getting those students through their bachelor's degrees. We want to make sure that that's the case. Right now we're transitioning the STEM projects and STEM disciplines to a point of being business focused, coming up with research that's going to actually be profitable. So in doing so, it's kind of like a little shift that a lot of people are having to undertake. Talked about, I mentioned some of the interdisciplinary exercises that we're trying to do here. And the first step is really kind of making those people that are our students that are in those disciplines aware of the marketplace. Surprise, like how many people go into disciplines and how they don't really think about profit, which is odd to me. Can I ask you, when you got into your technical discipline, did you think about, I guess, how it would affect the market from the standpoint of business?
No, I didn't. And to give you a little bit of background on my academic credentials, my PhD work was done in nuclear theory. So it's more of an academic endeavor and a long-term, short-term research. Most research is long-term, by the way. We weren't, well, I'll say this for myself. I didn't look at it as an entrepreneurial aspect and entrepreneurship. Back when I was a graduate student a few years before you guys started the UP program or whatever, I was actually in the graduate program with the person that runs the UP programs now at the NSF. But we didn't get that broad access to being well-rounded in those types of areas. Undergraduate work, you did your curriculum, you did the their basics of the elective courses that are like the humanities and things like that. Pushing us towards a business focus was not focused on. So none of us have real people skills. No, I'm just kidding. But we didn't get those classes. Yes, I said it. I did right here on Beyond the Classroom.
That's touchy.
Which is, well, it's truly, because, you know, we are so focused. We were. I'm just excited for the up-and-coming students that are in STEM-related programs that have those extra components built in or accessible to them. Because we were like, solve the problems, pass the qualifier, you know, graduate, and then apply to graduate school. I put the qualifier in there on the wrong side of it, but you get to graduate school. Then you start worrying about the qualifying exam and all of that and doing research. And then, you know, the pathway takes you down. Either you go to academia and you become a professor, researcher, tenured person, and a scholar, or you go to government or corporate and do research there. Now, mind you, a lot of us aren't doing that now, but the entrepreneurship came along as a, I can make more money doing that than I can being a researcher, which is one of the reasons I didn't go into research after my post-op.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I think one of the benefits for me is that I didn't start off in tech discipline. My dad was like extremely... he is extremely smart, extremely disciplined. He talked about my last name, it is Nigerian. And he came over and went to the same college I went to, which is the University of North Alabama, but he actually went after that to Georgia Tech to get his master's in engineering. Extremely brilliant guy. But I just saw firsthand how so much technical knowledge when applied, I wouldn't say within your best interest, against your best interest, I should say, but just not, well, not directly towards your benefit. Can a profit organization, which is fine, but you got to start, especially as a African Americans. We have to start looking at a way to profit off the true benefit of our research. Okay, and it's not just to work for someone else and give them the rights to that. If you got those brilliant ideas, you could just as well get an attorney or come up with some type of consortium and maybe make a deal with your attorney. Negotiate a way that if they help you get this patent protected in the correct way, that you can monetize it or go into the market and profit it from that technology. And y'all can split the revenues from it. So that's the thought process that I'm trying to drive and that we're trying to push here at Livingstone. And I think that it would behoove us just as a people to do so because it can really elevate us. Any thoughts on that? What do you think about it?
I do agree on that. And I was just thinking about my time that I spent organizing a session when I was at the National Society of Black Physicists conference a few years ago. One of the sessions that I was in charge of was to talk about alternative careers in physics or how to use your physics degree in alternative careers. And so my guest, one was a film director and film writer. The other one was in simulation and modeling. And he also was very much involved. I think he was the chairman or the president of the USDLA, United States Distance Learning Association. So they spoke on their experiences with respect to how a physics degree would benefit and does benefit the film industry and simulation and modeling with respect to training modules or video games or whatever. But the takeaway that I had was after the students listened and we had our after the session conversation, you know, the talk after the talk when everybody was meet and greet and everything. The students, a couple of them, or one in particular, I cannot remember his name, but the other ones agreed. We had a conversation about money and pay, and they felt as PhD majors or candidates even that were doing relevant work that they wanted to be compensated accordingly. So the example that was used was the projector in the room. Okay, projector manufacturer X is making all of the money off of the individual components that make the projector work. So that was the way they looked at it as being monetized. And so fair share should go to inventor person, whoever that came up with the short throw lens, for example. That was the point they were making. So our students are very much aware of the potential for profit and the value of the work they do. Plus, we are in a time where time is money. Skill sets are money. And as we also know, a lot of our youth have goals of being rich by means of sports or entertainment. They want to be a rapper. They want to be a basketball or football player because that's where the money is as far as their, you know, what they see. So in research, I think that that's the same thing along the lines of what our students need and want. I want to do research. But I need to get paid. I need a job that is going to sustain a particular type of lifestyle, particularly if the work dictates that or the company that they work for dictates that. So I concur completely, but I think that our students are more sensitive to profit and revenue than my generation was when we were studying science because we like science.
Yeah. Well, I think it has to be an end to a means to an end, so to speak. So I get that. There was a guy, this funny, you mentioned the National Black Physicist Society, I think it was. I forgot
the exact name. NSBP, National Society of Black Physicists, yes.
Yeah. Okay, about that. So essentially, I was privileged to go. One of my good friends, Dr. Renee Hort, asked me to go. And to kind of give my entrepreneurial thought process to some of the things they had going on there, which was essentially they had physicists a collective of physicists throughout North America, so Canada as well. And they wanted to figure out how they could help physicists monetize their ideas. And there was I think his name was Dr. Gates. It was an older gentleman.
Yes.
Seemed like he was seasoned in the field. He really kind of hit the point home when he said that if you're going to try to do anything that's worthwhile and just kind of set your mark, it has to be with some type of monetary focus behind it. And I thought that was extremely, I just thought it was smart. Let's just be honest about it. It was a really smart point because, I mean, like I told you, if you check my background, I'm my undergraduate was in business. So I'm an economist at heart. Okay. Mm-hmm. Capitalism drives our nation. That's what we're founded on. Okay. So you have to, try to find a way to carve your niche and put things in society. Some people kind of look at the way things are and then, in the perspective of, I do my job, I should be compensated, which is mm-hmm. an exchange of time and money. We know that.
Yes.
But that's not the only way to make money. We know that
right.
There's got to be some type of investment that has to take place. There has to be some type of growth that happens with that investment, we hope. And if you think about investment only as like purchasing stock or your 401k, I mean, that is a vehicle for investment for sure. But it's not the only way to do it. Being able to invest in yourself, start a business, is definitely one of the ways that you should go about and start an asset, so to speak. And that idea needs to be popularized amongst our HBCU scholars and STEM participants. But the deal is, it always comes up where you have the ideas of, well, do I just invest, or do I start my business, or something like that, and go full force with it? Well, I say no. You shouldn't do that. You need to say keep your daytime job, start a part-time business. You tinker around, and then you can figure out what you can put into the market from there. Okay, and that's just been my process. That's what I've done. Not a millionaire yet, but I'm working towards it. But I do have my businesses started, and they do generate revenue. So it's one of those things where you just kind of gotta, you just gotta do it. You gotta get your feet wet. It's like getting in the pool, just jump in the water, and you learn from there. You know.
Yes. Question. All right. Do you feel comfortable, or I'm just gonna ask you?
Yeah.
What types of businesses do you have?
Well, my businesses are not necessarily technical. The one I have is called Ego Elixir. It's a male personal care line.
Can you say that again?
Ego Elixir.
Okay.
It's a male personal care line. I sell that. And then I've got a couple other things. Some of the local movie theaters just thought would be great. Instead of selling butter popcorn, they sold different types of flavored popcorn. So we do that.
Mm-hmm.
These little businesses just get revenue coming in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And obviously you had an interest or an idea that you felt was worth pursuing to start these businesses. And obviously they were good ideas if you're generating revenue. So how
this
do you get?
True. Yeah.
Go ahead. Want to say something?
No, I was going to say, just quickly, from a standpoint of actually pushing tech, that's just on my personal, revenue generators. But from a standpoint of technology, while I was at the University of South Florida, which of course is one of the, it's a research school, one of the top research schools, from the way they apply for patents. I worked for their, licensing office, with my academics. And so we, helped them position some of those intellectual properties that they've, acquired through staff members and to put them in the market so that they can get maximum, profit off of.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that standpoint, I do have, some domain expertise within that realm of licensing and so forth. And really what I would say to your question of how, I think what you're going to ask me is how you can go through that method of generating revenue or starting a business. Is that what you're going to ask?
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Oh.
I have like two or three questions, but go ahead. No, go ahead and answer that one first. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like I said, it's one of those things where you just got to get started. First, you need to get like a base level knowledge. You don't have to go get your MBA or anything like that. Kind of learn on the fly. Of course, you don't have to read. You always need to do that. But just understanding intellectual property, okay, and understanding the ways that you can protect those ideas. I'll give you an example. One of the ways that you can do that is as far as like getting intellectual property and being able to put things in the market is understanding the laws and rules of intellectual property. We're on a first to file system. So essentially, people can go and they can get patents. The first person to file a patent for an idea, they tend to get preference to be awarded that patent, okay? Mm-hmm. But the patent process tends to be expensive.
Yes.
Most people estimate anywhere from like $5,000 to $50,000 if you're going to get it a great attorney to help you put those right claims in the patent. But something that they don't tell you about is there's something called a provisional patent.
Okay.
Provisional patent gives you the ability to just establish what they call prior art. Like you'll fill out the form. You don't have to go into extreme detail. But it gives you the ability to kind of vet your idea before you invest all that money we just talked about, the $5,000 to $50,000. And that lasts for a year. What you can do is you can write a provisional patent for an idea you have and kind of vet it within the market to still secure the rights for that idea after you found out if it got some ability to be monetized. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And a provisional patent only costs like $130. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a deep discount when you start thinking about that compared to the $5,000 to $50,000 range patents,
wow,
to go all the way without any full idea.
Yeah.
So just being kind of savvy,
mm-hmm,
being savvy to know how people play the game can go a long way. Get somebody that invests. I would say another thing that you can do is try to be a part of the market that you are going towards, or having some type of domain expertise within that industry or that you're trying, or target market you're trying to market your products toward, because that gives you a lot more cachet and a lot more it gives you the ability to relate more with the people that you're going after and can help you more accurately assess what those people are willing to buy. Does that make
right.
sense?
Yes, it makes
so,
perfect sense. That's looking for your niche or your demographic, and
yeah,
that tends to not be an easy process. So how do you streamline that process? But before we go any further, let me just remind any listeners who just joined us that we are having a great conversation with Professor James Fakunle of Livingstone College, and he's telling us about his program and what he does at Livingstone to blend STEM and entrepreneurship with the students in the HBCU Up program. So Professor Fakunle, you mentioned intellectual property.
Yeah.
And you talked about patents and you talked about provisional patents. I am learning so much from just talking to you right now about this actual topic. Let me ask you this. Is your business department at Livingstone involved in your endeavors to help to commercialize technology or science or research or whatever? Well,
we're working on it. We're definitely working on it.
Okay.
Right now, what we're wanting to do is, like you said earlier, is to establish that environment of interdisciplinary activities and then work toward monetizing it. There are very few HBCUs that I'm aware of, I'll just say that, and I'm not a specialist by any means. But there are very few that I know of that are in not just research, but in a standpoint that they're doing a collaborative effort with students, institutions, and, whatever corporate interests that they can come up with, and they're monetizing that. I'm not aware of any of that, anything except for maybe ANT. I think ANT has done some work in the past after talking to a gentleman. Those things are what we're actually working on. Somewhat of an uphill battle, but I think in the long run, it'll be something profitable for Livingstone College. We've got a president here, President Jimmy R. Jenkins. He's extremely interested in that idea, and setting up an ecosystem for that interdisciplinary aspect and bringing entrepreneurship into a relationship with STEM. So hopefully we'll have something a little more
robust.
A little more tangible to talk about next time we'll talk.
Yes.
But yeah, we're in the process of building that ecosystem now.
That's great. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, in addition to what we've just discussed about IP, is HBCUs and IP policy. And I know you can speak to what your policy is at Livingstone, or if you have one. What I have found is that several HBCUs, I won't say all of them because I have not researched nor worked at all of them, but the intellectual property laws or policies there don't tend to benefit the researcher a whole lot. So if you come up with like Facebook, for example, which is the most common example of entrepreneurship at a college campus, the inventor of Facebook doesn't have to give 99% of his profits to Harvard because he did it while he was a student at Harvard. So tell me how the policy, if you have one, works, and how do we get to a point where we become the ecosystems that we should be, which is to help to cultivate talent. We want to be players. We want to be accepted. We want to be taken seriously in the tech space, in the science space. We want to be eligible and, you know, considered for venture capital, for angel investors, all of those things that it takes to build out that company, be an entrepreneur, have a great, fabulous idea that nobody else has come up with.
Mm-hmm.
But if one of your students sitting at Livingstone College in Salisbury, North Carolina, has the next greatest best thing, how can he or she, I'm going to say, how can she take her idea and develop it and cultivate it within the confines of Livingstone College without Livingstone College saying, we own that?
Well, that's going to be...
Yeah, I'm starting some stuff right here on Beyond the Classroom. We're starting stuff right here because it's real. It is so
real.
It's more real than you know. Because I'm not saying we don't get great professors, but there are some professors who are deeply engrossed in doing applied research. That's the difference between pure research and applied research. You take something, you come up with an idea or a concept, and you know that it's going to generate a product. And you are like, if I do it over here, they're going to claim it for their own because I work for them. How do we address that and get to the point where we let the schools know it's a win-win? It's not just a win and then somebody goes away and gets $10 for their great invention and the school's making revenue into perpetuity. Because, and after I get off this soapbox for a second, the MITs and the Stanfords that produce a lot of patent from their researchers and their students, those people that get mega rich, they give mega back. They got buildings named after them or libraries or rooms or wings of libraries because they were able to thrive in those environments. How do we get to the point where you have a James Fukunle West Wing on the brand new science building that was built because you have contributed money because you made money and you want to support Livingstone. Now, I'm on the soapbox. You go ahead.
Okay, fine. Well, let me just go ahead and tell you that I'm aware of university policies for innovation. I've studied them quite a bit. As far as ours goes, it is not the most inventor-friendly system and a lot of HBCUs because we got friends that are around. And it's not because I don't believe it's because they don't want to make the environment investor friendly at all. I think it's more of a it may be just a sense where they just don't know exactly how the field works. Which is understandable because that's not been our aim before. For the most part, our aim was to get students and that didn't have traditional, the way HBCUs were started were to take our students, which are African Americans who couldn't go to those traditional schools, and then give them the formal schooling that they needed to go out and be professional. Well, the aim was different. If you go to Stanford, they know that they're making engineers to go out to enterprise. I mean, just a very, I do a study in one of my classes on how Silicon Valley got started. If you know how Silicon Valley got started, it was a relationship between Stanford University and the American government, the wartime effort. Okay, mm-hmm. They just really took advantage of it. They got professors on board. One of the guys, around World War II. Stanford wasn't even a powerhouse like we think of it today when it comes to engineering. Most people thought of those schools on the East Coast. You think about the Manhattan Project and where those profits went to. Stanford wasn't even a player. But one of the guys who was a part of he was working with Harvard. Let me not get into the particulars. It's kind of eluding me now. But he was on the East Coast. He was a graduate from Stanford. He ended up taking the whole idea of taking technology and licensing it to the government, coming up with different types of technologies for the government. He ended up taking that concept back to Stanford, and he got all of his engineering professors and gave them automatic tenure. And what they did was they began to engineer ideas that they could make profit off by selling to organizations that were associated with the government and its war effort. Okay, so that's how Silicon Valley got started. So they were actually the first, but they were the one that made that trend extremely lucrative. Okay, from there you got your rollout of different things that comes along with Silicon Valley and angel investors, venture capital, and so forth. But it started right out of Stanford, and so they had to come up with a lucrative university policy for investment. And if you get somebody that studies how that works and how it's mutually beneficial to kind of let go of the reins, loosen the chain a little bit, then, I mean, you'll get somebody that understands that. The aim, though, has to be towards going into those fields of profit through entrepreneurship and whatever it may be. We say it's biology, chemistry, any type of STEM research. Somebody that's actively going for it and knows the landscape. And I think it's just a STEM, a lot of our institutions are, like I said, they're great institutions. They just aren't familiar with the process. I've done a lot of research on those IP policies for universities, and some of them are really good. Some of them are with a 50-50 base. That's how it was at the University of South Florida when I was there, where they would get 50% of the profits or whatever was made to the intellectual property to the student, and then, of course, 50% would go to the university. But the university also would use its licensing office to help patent and cover the fees. So it was something that was extremely beneficial for the entrepreneur, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. There are a lot of different ones. Columbia's got one. I don't know if Columbia is as investor-friendly as that one, but it's still somewhat friendly. So you got a lot of different trends between institutions, and they just need to research it and put something in a place. Yeah. And that will not happen, I believe, until, it's my personal opinion, until you come up with that ecosystem where you come up with a decision that's what you want to shoot for, okay? You come up with that decision, and then you come up with the ecosystem to support it, then you got to tweak your legislation within your university policy for innovation, mm-hmm. and you'll see the things begin to thrive from there.
Right. And one of the advantages, I do believe, is the fact that some of the universities and colleges are private versus state in the state system. So it may be a bigger challenge for the state universities to come up with a policy if it doesn't go along with what the other universities in that state system are doing, for example, North Carolina.
I don't think so, actually.
You think they can come up with individual IP policies at the individual state schools, and that's okay?
Well, I think that the president could probably set that up. Now, I'm not a fisher, so don't quote me on that. But I am aware that different state schools, just within the same state, mm-hmm. have different policies. So okay. it's not a blanket that just fits all institutions, because all institutions are different, right?
Right.
Some are
that
research, some are not.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Yeah, but it's different for institutions, even public or private.
Well, I know definitely for private. Private has a whole lot more latitude to make policy and get policy approved. It probably may not even have to go board level, but if it does, I mean, they have their own board as opposed mm-hmm. to having to work within the system of chancellors or whatever they're called when you have a state system. So you guys are private, right?
We are.
I tend to frown upon we don't know, because if we don't know, we can find out. So if we don't know, we don't want to know. And I know that most of the universities with intellectual property policies, larger institutions are very transparent about everything. They put everything on the website. If you're looking for it, you can find it. We, as HBCUs, we put information out there. We don't put everything out there. And if there is an intellectual property policy, there may not be a reference to it. There, I'm sure, is part of the onboarding process, a document that you sign, you know, to agree to whatever those terms are. But to have someone oversee that process and maybe tweak it or rewrite it completely, because intellectual property comes in so many forms now, mm-hmm. It should be something that we focus on and get in the game a little bit better. Because if we're losing talent, students and or faculty to other universities because they're policy is more robust, then that's not a win for us overall. But having people like you involved in doing things and pushing students to see the relationship, I think is a benefit overall in the fact that you're spreading your information. So you want to comment?
Well, I would say this. I'm not a specialist in the way HBCUs operate. However, I know business, and I know that there's a beauty to cooperation, okay?
Mm-hmm. yes.
It kind of reminds me of, what's this guy's name? Was it Rockefeller that said, competition is a sin? So people tend to cooperate in businesses, mm-hmm. and everybody can profit off of it. Even the NBA, National Basketball Association, they do profit sharing. What I would say is that if you could come up with some type of situation where HBCUs had consortiums, where they aligned on purpose to go and actually worked in a spirit of harmony, where they could go forward towards a particular industry. Hey, we're going towards cancer research. Hey, we're going towards engineering of, cars,
hybrid vehicles. Let's say that.
You can go hybrid vehicles, or you can go with, we're going to actually take all our time and focus on just some industry an industry that has a outlook where it's just going to be extremely lucrative if you come after something. I think that we could really explode economically in a positive way. By doing so, just because, historically African Americans have made incredible inventions that have just increased the living standard all across the world, from peanut butter to toilets to traffic lights. You think about it, African Americans mm-hmm. specifically have had their hand in it. Even electricity with Thomas Edison and how he, an African American was right at the base of that being founded. So, mm-hmm. It's not like the talent isn't here. Mm-hmm. One thing it has to do is it has to be cultivated and pushed right. within a certain realm, just like you would with a sport, athlete, or anything that you go after. Most people tend to hit their mark, especially when given the right resources and the right drive and motivation.
Right, and the right resources, as you said, facilities to carry it out. motivation, and they need a champion. Because if you don't have a champion behind you to, you know, run interference, make sure you can get what you need, if you don't have a way to get it, then you may get to the point where you succeed and get that product or that idea developed completely. But a lot of times you won't get there if you don't have somebody who says, I believe in this thing and I'm going to help you get it done. And unless you're just rich and you just sitting around thinking about stuff like Rocket Man, Elon Musk and Richard Branson, they have plenty of money to go and do what they want to do because they've already gotten there. But we have to get there. And
we're working toward it, that's for sure.
We are definitely working toward it. And coming up with something, and I just came up with a great idea. I don't even want to say it out loud, but
don't say it. Write it down.
I'll write it down because, you know, it's something that I think is relevant, particularly with the way technology is being used now and the way that we use our devices, our smartphones. I mean, they're like our third hand almost. You know, nobody goes anywhere.
It is definitely an extension of ourselves, yeah.
Yeah, it is an extension of ourselves. And with millennials now, do you find your students looking towards things that are more related to the fact that we are a digital community now? We do what we do with our phones. We do what we do with our laptops. As you know, those are the things that bring us information. Those are the things that keep us connected to others. And so how do you see your STEM students as it pertains to the digital technology that we have available today and looking to make improvements or new ideas as it relates to that?
Well, I'm getting them to the point now where they're trying to think about making new uses for the technology that we have. Mm-hmm. A lot of the students now are just at the point where they're learning code. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, beginning to stretch out and grow within that their framework. But I'm working, like I told you, to get to the point to where they're thinking about, hey, man, there is a gaping hole within this industry, or hey, there's an opportunity to take mm-hmm. this particular situation and move it into something else. Like, there's just so much that you can do with technology. And the beautiful part of it is that the investment doesn't really cost that much. I mean, if you mm-hmm. got a computer and Mountain Dew and some, you know, it doesn't take much to come up with the process for technology. Whereas if you want to start a trucking company, you got to get those assets, you got to get some capital up front. That makes sense.
Yes, so it does. I've had a trucking company, I know what it takes.
That's interesting. I don't know, but what I would say is that, like, you have to get you have to try to come up with a way to capitalize, I would say almost exploit the conditions that thrive. There's a guy, his name is Dr. Claude Anderson. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's out of the D.C. area. He does a lot of books. He talks about Powernomics is what it's called. Powernomics. Mm-hmm. And it's a plan that he lays for to help African Americans, or Black Americans, as he puts it, take advantage of their economic destiny. Mm-hmm. One of the things he said was to kind of go back into some of the traditional ways of doing things, because his idea was that we were moving forward towards technology, and technology, in its essence, had a gaping flaw. If the electricity went out, that there would be, we would have to start over.
Yes, exactly.
And so you wanted to go back to, like, manning land, and, I don't know, going in the industries that African Americans particularly are a part of, like, one of the largest consumers of leather, different things of that nature, fishing and stuff like that. Well, I agree with them in theory, but right now technology is so powerful, so potent, and the investment capital that you need to get into the game is not as high. The threshold is not as high in some other industries. So I think that it would behoove us to invest heavily into that. And there's so much money to be made in technology. It's still a relatively young industry. So you can go, you are in technology. Very rarely I found people that are in the tech realm that retire poor. I mean, it's just not something that happens a lot. If you know what you're doing and you pursue something within that field, there's money to be made.
Yes.
So it's that's why I'm in CIS. That's why I'm in, I deal with computers. Just, I love it, but there's the profit margins off of it are huge.
Right. But we wised up because most scientists from previous generations died in poverty. They were very focused on their work. They did great things, and I'm going to talk about a couple of them. One was Nikola Tesla. Tesla, now he has a car named after him, but he's dead. But Tesla did such amazing work in magnetism and so many other fields that, you know, his work was being stolen by corporations, and they could just take your stuff and patent it and, you know, make a product and get rich. And I'll give you another example. Dr. Leon Lederman, he was a nuclear theorist. He just passed away a few months ago. And I had a personal, not friend-like relationship, but I had a relationship with Dr. Lederman. He was the one that named the God particle the God particle. And I met him as a graduate student right after he got his Nobel Prize. And, you know, I was like, I made a promise to him. So that's my little story with him. You can look it up. I'll send you the link. But
okay.
My point is, he won a Nobel Prize. When he got older and his health started to decline, he had to sell his Nobel Prize to keep up with the care for his health. Being able to achieve greatness and great things, notoriety, write books, and then end up on the wrong end of the financial spectrum sucks. I'm just saying it.
Yeah.
That is not the right way to go. Nobody with a beautiful mind should be taken advantage of by those with devious minds. And that's what happens. Devious minds win. They always win.
Well,
I'm not trying to paint a bad picture, but I want to say that we need to figure out a way to not end up in that kind of situation. Because
I agree with you 100%.
Because I believe completely in scholarship. And that's what those scientists that came before us, they were in it because of the discoveries. I mean, granted, they needed to pay their bills too, but getting rich was not the focus. It was about the stimulation of the brain, figuring out problems, doing those things. And now we have to figure out problems still and do those things. But now the focus is, if I figure this thing out, figure that thing out, I'll get rich. So I'm not opposed to getting rich, like I'm saying. I'm just saying, how do we find that balance between scholarship and finances? Because if you're focused on the money, you may lose focus on the fact that there's something better that you could have done were you spending more time focusing on the scholarship.
Well, I've got a theory on that.
Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, I think that the only way you can really, truly do it is you got to have partnerships. Okay?
Yes.
No man's an island unto himself.
Mm-hmm.
So if that be the case, what you need to do, or what I would recommend, is, and what we teach entrepreneurship in the perspective of one innovator.
Mm-hmm.
Innovators typically that person that's creative. They come up with that next best idea, the next greatest thing, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the entrepreneurial manager. That person's more business savvy. They don't come up with the idea, but they know how to set it up and give it the proper framework to push it through the market.
Mm-hmm.
So typically you have a mix of those two that can help push those ideas forward. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the person that's an innovator does need to have some base level knowledge. You got to understand intellectual property. Was it a Greek saying that they used to say not too much? You don't want to go too high. You don't want to go too low. You want to be right in the middle so you can get a good enough balance.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's kind of what you got to do. You can't just, well, you can innovate without thinking about the commercial aspects of it. But that does leave you open to being exploited by some
yes.
corporate interests.
Yes.
And typically, people want, I should say it like this, intellectual property and the whole idea of intellectual property was brought about to spur innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't look at research without looking at it from a business and legal type of format. I mean, there's the science behind it. There's the research nature or whatever the discipline may be, but you got to look at it from business and legal,
right.
without looking
they
at
do.
It from those. Yeah, I mean, they should have before, and it may have helped alleviate certain things, but everybody, like, today's the information age. They didn't have the access to information like we do now. So we could be a lot more savvy in the way we handle ourselves as STEM professionals when we go forward and do applied research. That's what we're doing here. That's what we want to push. I've got a lot of good friends in at these historical black colleges around North Carolina and some in Alabama, because, of course, that's where I'm from. But there are a lot of people who are pushing that, those ideas. I know South, JCSU, Johnson Smith University.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson C. Smith, I should say, University. They've got a great program over there where they've got a tech department that's pushing innovation in STEM. They're pushing the business aspects of it. Maybe not as much as the legal, but I'm not quite sure about it. I'm sure they're teaching them something. But you have to marry those three together. If you don't, it does leave a hole to be exploited, you know? So the guy, just to add a little levity, it was a situation where on a TV show, this guy had a triangle. We called it the contractor's triangle, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said on three sides of the triangle, you got three attributes. You can have two, but you can't have all three. And it was that you could build something that was good on one end of the triangle, fast, and cheap on the other side. So you have something good and fast, but it won't be cheap. You have it cheap and good, but it won't be fast. You see what I'm saying? And if that's kind of how some people look at innovation. They look at it without looking at it full circle, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? And they look at situations and they think just too singularly on one thing without trying to encompass everything that takes part in the whole process. And like you said, using silos, they kind of just putting things within one department and not intermingling. The whole beauty of innovation is the intermingling of different things to make stuff go and be commercially viable. Guess that analogy didn't really hold any water with that, but I just thought it was cool. Anyway, that's what you want to do. You want to try to come up with a way that you can put together something that's going to be beneficial for the end user. And something that can actually be done by the people who are producing it, okay? And
yes.
to do that, you have to have some type of, you got to have some collaboration. So I'll leave it at that.
You do have to have some cooperation. And once again, let me say we are here chatting with Professor Fakunle from Livingstone College, and we're discussing entrepreneurship, STEM, intellectual property, and how we can get our students engaged in looking at their research efforts and ideas from an entrepreneurial standpoint so that they're prepared to create and they're prepared to profit at the same time. And in closing, before we go, I just want to mention this real quickly. Speaking of intellectual property and products and making sure that you are covered, you know, and this is the person I wanted to have on my show for my first show. I'm still going to pursue this. Dr. Lonnie Johnson, Super Soaker King, and
oh, yeah.
so many different patents, products. I didn't realize he was the person that also was over Nerf toys. This is his thing. But for Hasbro to, you know, cut him out of some of his revenue, I'm proud to say I found out that wasn't all of it. I was like, they made $1 billion off Super Soaker. All he got was $80 million. No, that's not true. But they did owe him some money that he finally just got because he had been in litigation with them. But being able to recognize the fact that people will try to take advantage of you, especially when you come up with something that is so huge that, you know, they can't help. They have all the infrastructure in place. We can build that. We sure can. Let's go ahead and build that, or, you know, recreate it. And people, and don't think that if you mention something to one person that has the means to do it, that they won't try to get it done before you. So being able to educate our students, talk to our students at HBCUs, and get them caught up with what so many other places have already had in place for so long, I commend you for working in that arena by trying to make sure our students are educated, not just with their disciplines in STEM, but also crossing over to the business department side of it and making sure that the connection is made, because the connection is not often made, because we tend to work in the process of, oh, I made this discovery. Let me write a paper and publish it in a scientific journal so everybody can see it. And then you draw out the diagram of what you did and all that. Next thing you know, R&D in somebody's company is making that thing or using it because it's what they needed in order to build something. So,
yeah, you gotta respect those ideas. You gotta respect them for sure.
Right. And being scholarly is fine, but when you have something that needs to be protected, writing about it, write about it, but don't write everything about it. You know, present about it. Don't present everything about it. You know, being able to.
If you feel like you got to push it out there that quick for visual patent, you can do it in an hour. You know, I mean, it doesn't take long at all.
That is awesome information to have. Provisional patents done in 1 hour, and not for thousands, for hundreds, not even hundreds, $130. And before we go, Professor Fakunle, it's been a pleasure. Can you tell everyone how to get in touch with you if they have questions about intellectual property and patents and business and STEM? Because I have a whole lot of questions. I mean, if we could talk a little longer, which we could, but I'm trying to, you know, be respectful of your time. Not really. No, I'm just kidding. I just love talking about things that I'm passionate about, and I love talking to passionate people. So let our listeners know how to get in touch with you if, you know, you're on social media, follow you or your website or wherever, so we can see the great things that you are doing with the students at Livingstone.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you this. I can be reached. My phone number is 256-366-8566. Or you can reach me on email. I'm working on getting better at that. Get my assistant to start checking it. But it's J. F is in Frank, A is in Apple, KUNLE at livingstone.edu. So, and that should work pretty good. If you got any legitimate questions, please feel free to contact me. That's not an issue at all. So, Dr. Coleman, it was a pleasure interviewing with you. Let me say that.
Well, thank you so much. And it was a pleasure interviewing with you as well. And until next time, thank you for listening in on Beyond the Classroom, and we will talk again soon.